Every key stage of David Bowie's career was marked by a different creative foil. Mick Ronson's lead guitar work helping to launch Ziggy into an unsuspecting world. Brian Eno's game-changing technical wizardry during the Berlin period. Nile Rodgers' trademark grooves taking Bowie to new commercial heights in the 80s. Fripp doing his thing as well. Tony Visconti, of course, as producing Bowie in the early years and then coming back as well. But Bowie also worked with other people, collaborators, and they're pretty much unknown. You may or may not know that Bowie was a producer on the Stooges' third album, Lust for Life. And here to tell me a little bit more about the hookups that Bowie had through his amazing career is Jason Draper, former head of creation at Universal Music, which is one of the best titles ever, and longtime music journalist, quote-unquote. Good morning to you, Jason.
Morning, Giles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. A bit of Iggy Pop in the morning gets you going. That's definitely Pop, Snapple, and Crack, isn't it?
That's not quite.
So we know as Bowie as Starman, we know him as the Changeling, the man who sold the earth and the man who sold the world and fell to earth, and basically was a creative force right up until his death. I mean, well, that's one of the great ironies, isn't it? All the great marks of him that the final album was critically acclaimed just before his death, but very few people know about Bowie and his collaborations.
No, you're right. And it's interesting. The guys that you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation there were all kind of facilitators, weren't they? Bowie had a vision and these guys helped him kind of bring it to life. When it comes to other collaborators that sort of maybe Bowie was working in on their own music, it sort of shifts a little bit and you start to get Bowie kind of projecting himself onto these people and almost remaking them in his image, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and the other thing is, obviously, these collaborations kind of come from the mid-70s onwards, because up until he goes from being Davy Jones in, 66, 67, and he goes, yeah, and then he changes to Bowie because of another, he doesn't want to be confused with the Monkees front man or whatever. But up until that point, he is driven by, he knows he's going to be a star. You know, forget Gaga putting out a roadmap on Madonna. Bowie has the original roadmap. He gets the band together, the Spiders. They record three defining albums, if you like, in a very short period of time. Hunky Dory, of course, Ziggy and Atlanta. And then he drops the Spiders like a hot potato. He goes through some interesting periods, with his own being. And then, he gets clean, he sobers up, he gets a new outlook on life. And so basically from the mid-70s onwards, he's able to look outside his own sort of ego and his own self-interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can kind of see seeds of that in some of this earlier period as well. There was a band before the Spiders called The Hype, which Bowie didn't front, but he kind of was a Svengali character for. And it effectively had the Spiders musicians in it, but was fronted by Bowie's fashion designer, funnily enough. And then they became the Spiders. And this ties into that thing of Bowie projecting himself onto other people for a little bit and then kind of working out in a way what he can do with what he's projected, if that makes sense. If you take Iggy's first album, The Idiot, that's pre-Low. Bowie recorded it before the Low album, came out after the Low album. But you see seeds in the songs Nightclubbing there, a very sparse song built on a drum machine pattern. I think Iggy Pop later recalled Bowie telling him, "I can't release this in my own music." And Iggy said, "Well, I can." But then Bowie hears it and he goes, "Oh, actually, that's quite interesting." And you see that sort of drum, those starts to use drum machines a bit more and these kind of more atmospheric things. That also, there's a song, I think, that closes The Idiot called Mass Production, which is built on tape loops, very weird atmospheric avant-garde thing. And so he's kind of almost put that into Iggy's music and then gone, "Oh, actually, I know how I can bring that back into mine and kind of do my thing of that," which is when he hooks up with Eno and then goes into the sort of Berlin trilogy. And that's kind of how the Iggy thing actually started a bit earlier with Raw Power, the first Stooges album, where you get Bowie, same with Lou Reed at this time, Bowie's getting his idols and he's almost trying to, as I've said, kind of remake them in his image. But also these guys are at a doldrums at this point and Bowie's at a peak and he's got his idols. He's kind of bringing them out a little bit, if that makes sense. So, Lou Reed, he was always skirting around this kind of underworld era, this kind of, what we would now call sort of queer lifestyle, this kind of cross-dressing world with Andy Warhol's people and that sort of thing. And it's perfect for the Bowie, another collaborator, John Lennon, said, "Well, it's rock and roll with lipstick on, isn't it?" And Lou Reed in that Transformer era, that's perfect for what Bowie was doing. He kind of remade Lou Reed in that image, if that makes sense.
Can I come out, ask you a question here? How important was Angie, his wife, as an opening the door to that New York scene? Because Angie she wanted to be seen as talented, or at least an artist in the same way as a New York performance artist. And she brings in that androgyny, and she brings in that whole, you mentioned it, it's the queer scene before the queer scene is now fashionable. I mean, how much of a door opener was it? I mean, I know she becomes a distraction, to put it mildly, you know, halfway through, but there are, you know, you do see pictures of Angie hanging out with Iggy, and somebody like Lou, who is fiercely intelligent but difficult, you know, was she the sort of, if you like, a touchstone so Bowie could feel comfortable around these, you know, these, not flamboyant, but these different, you know, I mean, you know, Iggy's punk. Iggy is a punk. Iggy is a force of nature. And where everybody else is putting down 8-track, 16-tracks, you know, Rick Wakeman doing piano solos, I mean, Iggy's going out there like, you know, like a tsunami.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Angie's a really interesting character in that, you kind of touched upon her history just now, and she was also, I think she studied couture at school, which brings in the costume side of things already from that theatrical side. And so she really early on, you've got Bowie, and again, you touched on this a little bit just then. Bowie is quite a quiet, you know, he's this great flamboyant performer, but as a person, he's quite a quiet, considered, thoughtful person. And Angie is the stereotypical brash. She wasn't a New Yorker. She was actually Cypriot, I believe. But she was the stereotypical brash New Yorker of the era. And she had this great sort of peroxide blonde hair and very loud and very, and if you put them both in a room together, they were for a period a kind of glam rock power couple. But Bowie, bit of an observer, because although Bowie was a mainstream rock artist, he was always an outsider, and he was sort of outside looking in and observing. Angie was often sort of getting the attention, being so loud. People know who Bowie is, but Angie kind of drives the conversation. And so to tie this into this New York scene a bit, if you think of Andy Warhol's factory and Andy, you know, the whole Andy Warhol troupe that Bowie was fascinated with, when they came to London, they performed the Andy Warhol play Pork in 1971, I believe, at the Roundhouse in London. And Bowie and Angie went, and they were both in awe of this production. And it was full of, you know, Andy Warhol sort of transvestite group, and then these other people who are kind of these larger than life characters that filled all his movies. They met them at the end of the show to kind of effuse about how great they thought the show was. And actually, Bowie at this point was a sort of long-haired, hunky-dory-looking Bowie, baggy trousers and all that sort of stuff. He wasn't the Ziggy Bowie yet. And it's interesting that the Andy Warhol troupe were not, weren't taken by Bowie. He's just this quiet folk-looking guy. But Angie's the, you know, the New Yorker that they can identify with. And I think to your point, that kind of helped Bowie a little bit ease him into that world. He was always fascinated with that, even from his trip over. And yeah, she was sort of a bit of a connector to create that energy and to kind of bring those people around him.
But it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you talk about, you know, the factory and Andy Warhol's troupe and Little Joe and Eddie and all them all coming over and that being that big sort of transvestite brash in your face, you know, we're queer, we're here, we're not going shopping sort of crowd. But, you know, one of Bowie's major influences is Lindsay Kemp. You know, the mime artist, you know, and you look at Bowie's stuff that he's doing, you know, in the 60s, he's doing mime productions as well as big, because he's not quite sure what artist he wants to be. And so, yeah. you know, up until that point, it's a very sort of British folkloric sort of almost Victoriana, you know, kink sled sort of reflections on suburbia that Bowie is. But once he gets in touch with the New York crowd, suddenly he becomes, you know, the Bowie of the mid-70s, and that's when the collaborations start.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of tie that in a little bit with the Velvet Underground as well, who were kind of Andy Warhol's group, weren't they? And I believe I'm correct in saying Bowie was probably one of the first people in the UK to own the Velvet Underground album, the debut album. And there's that great quote, which is attributed to Brian Eno. I think that's possibly apocryphal. But Eno apparently said only 10,000 people bought this album, the Velvet Underground one, but they all went and formed a band. Bowie got an early version of this album and immediately started playing the songs live, particularly Waiting for the Man was one of the ones she used to play. And so you get that at the end of the Hunky Dory record, there's that song Queen Bitch, which is almost Bowie's version, you know, in my bibbly bobbly hat. That was Bowie's version of the Velvet Underground before Bowie kind of leapfrogged into the Ziggy era, if that makes sense.
So when does I mean, New York in the mid-50s, one of my favourite... And I didn't really know it that well, but I've been delving in. And there are... New York in that 50s... Because New York now, it's all so high Tribeca, it's very glamorous. But New York in the mid-70s was pretty dangerous, basically. Even if you were a rock star. You've got Lennon hiding out there post-Beatles. He's gone on his famous Lost Weekend that lasts for 3 years with the... Not with Yoko.
May Pang,
thank you. You've got what's going on in, you know, the Bowery. You've got CBGB's just coming. You've got this incredible sort of scene coming up with Talking Heads, Blondie, Ramones, etc. It's bubbling under nicely there. You've got the, you know, they're about to, you know, a couple of years later, they make a film, The Warriors, which isn't a million miles away from riding on the tubes. So what was it like creatively? And why, you know, I mean, for example, Fame, which gives, you know, Bowery a massive hit later on, but also massive for Lennon as well. You know, how do those two meet up, and how does Lennon come into the crowd? And how does Barry actually, what's it like to work with Barry? What sort of producer was he?
So to go to the Lennon question first, so that's a really interesting one. Bowie was always a Lennon fan. And why wouldn't you be? You know, they are ostensibly different songwriters, but if you scratch under the surface a bit, there's a cynicism to both of them. There's a sort of, Fame is interesting enough if you listen to the song. It's a dissatisfaction with Fame. It's not a celebration with Fame. It's, hey, we've got all this stuff, but what does it bring? It's quite empty. It's quite sort of plastic. And so Bowie had actually, the album that Fame is on is the Young Americans album. Bowie had gone into a soul phase at this point, what he called plastic soul, influenced by the Philadelphia sound. Bowie had actually more or less finished the Young Americans album at this point, and they were mixing it. But he found an opportunity to get into the studio with Lennon. And I think he kind of encouraged Lennon into the studio by saying, oh, we're recording a version of Across the Universe, which ends up being at the end of Fame, the Beatles song, which was a Lennon-written Beatles song on the Let It Be album. And so I kind of always felt a little bit like he wanted to get Lennon in the studio to sort of show off a bit, to sort of say, hey, I'm recording one of your songs. Come on in. This is going to be great. And then it kind of turned into they were working on a jam of a song by an old 50s R&B group called The Flares. It was called Foot Stomping. Bowie had started moving into the soul sound on the Diamond Dogs tour. They'd been playing Foot Stomping there. And I think Bowie tried to kind of lay down a version of it in the studio that wasn't working. He got Carlos Alomar's lead guitar part. He kind of edited around a bit and then turned it into the guitar part for Fame. Now, Lennon's real contribution to this song, actually, is just to do the high-pitched vocals on the chorus. That was more or less it. I don't think he really wrote any lyrics. I think Bowie kind of was really the driving force in this. But it's interesting, Bowie has always said that song would not exist were it not for Lennon being in the studio. If he didn't maybe necessarily write the song, his influence and his presence is what brought the song about, which I always thought was quite interesting.
And it's also interesting, isn't it? You mentioned how, you know, he likes the Lennon song. He wants to do a version of Across the Universe. I, for my sins, in the 80s, bought the cassette of Tin Machine, you know, which dates me. Yeah, I know you're laughing now. But he's got Working Class Hero on it, which is obviously, you know, one of Lennon's most visceral songs.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And they kind of shared a relationship, a friendship relationship, all throughout until Lennon's death. And I think there's Bowie had always honoured that, if you like, in things like this, in doing Working Class Hero. I think he also later on did Mother, for a charity album. I can't remember what the charity was for, but that was around 1990, so still the early 90s period. There's a really wonderful story, and Bowie tells it in his sort of usual wry manner on stage in Hong Kong during the Let's Dance tour, where one of the last times he met Lennon together, they were both in Japan, and they were going through a flea market, and they found an old Beatle jacket, you know, like the old, you know, collarless ones that Lennon used to wear in the early days. And the way Bowie tells it was, I did something very uncharacteristic at the time, and I asked Lennon if he would wear it so that I could take a photo. So you've got, you know, late 70s Lennon wearing early 60s Beatles jacket. And then Bowie's sort of wry joke at the end was, oh, well, I think he'd outgrown it by that point, which was a very sort of particular Bowie joke to sort of tell, yeah.
The 80s roll on, and I like, yeah, that whole Philadelphia soul. I mean, I could talk to you about, you know, all bits and pieces with you know, the Heroes album and Blackout and Joe the Light. But anyway, the 80s come in. And Bowie, you know, out of left field brings out Let's Dance. Huge. If you were there and you remember how big it was. But also in the 80s, strangely, because he's, you know, we go through that sort of New York period, we go through his mime period, he becomes, if you like, commercial, but he's still got his own integrity. And you just look at some of the people he works with, and we've got Queen under pressure. brilliant, really, really brilliant. But then there's, you know, putting out Fire with Gasoline with Moroder. And Moroder is an interesting artist. He's, you know, if you're looking at disco and you're looking at film and the cross between and the, you know, the sound that basically is EDM stroke Daft Punk stroke everything that's going on now, that's Moroder. Moroder is hot wired into the DNA. And then he's in, you know, then he's into one of, and if you like your guitarist, you will know the name Pat Metheny. Otherwise you'll go, eh? But he's, again, he is the hottest thing in the 80s in the guitar world, and not in the terms of the Stevie Vay, Eddie Van Halen world, but he is putting down some serious jazz riffs. So how is he collaborating with these people and bringing them into, you know, it's just showing the wide kaleidoscope of music he's interested in, isn't it, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And let's take Moroder and Nile Rodgers as a starting point there. Nile, of course, produced the Let's Be Out. The Let's Dance.
Yes. Let's like, that that, that would be an minutes. Album and a half, wouldn't it? You know, Bowie and Lennon, Let's Be.
But you're right. Moroder was kind of this pioneering electro producer who kind of obviously hit the big fame with I Feel Love, the Donna Summer song, which basically created disco as we know it in a way, or this sort of modern version of disco. And at the same time, Nile Rodgers was actually influenced by Moroder as well. So when you get some of the chic stuff, Nile didn't realize that Moroder was using a drum machine. So Nile started to try and recreate this sound himself in the studio with the early chic songs. Fast forward 6 years, Nile and Bowie are together, kind of doing Bowie's version of chic with Nile that, as you say, he became a megastar making pop songs at this point. But it's kind of a post-disco thing, isn't it? And if you look up to Scary Monsters, which is kind of kicking down the door for the new romantic scene, there's a 3-year break, and then Bowie comes back with this great big post-disco pop album. But I think it's probably fair to say would have been a good portion of it is Nile's vision as well. That's a great story. Bowie wrote Let's Dance as a folk song, almost as an acoustic song. And I know that you've had your own experience with Nile here. I think Bowie is a great conceptionist. And that was the other thing when we talked about earlier, his collaborators bringing his vision to life. Nile is a great architect. So he could see what Bowie had, and then he could put it all together. And it's the same in all the chic stuff. Everything Nile is on, his production, his performance is so precise. And you can see that Nile went, oh, I see what you've got there, but I know how we can make this a big hit. And then you extrapolate that across the whole of that album. You've got Let's Dance on there. You've got China Girl on there, which, funnily enough, is a song Bowie originally wrote with and for Iggy, and then covered himself in 83 to put on the Let's Dance album. So you get all these intertwining things of all Bowie's sort of past coming up to his present.
But you see, Bowie would never have bought on a bass line that there isn't on China Girl, or a guitarist like Stevie Ray Vaughan on something on like Let's Dance albums, which was, Stevie Ray Vaughan at that point was, again, the hottest thing in blues, in new blues music. And again, bring something to that and to Modern Love that we didn't have before.
No, absolutely. And I think this ties in with, you also get, while Bowie's becoming more commercial in this era, he's also becoming a person that he's always been able to spot talent, but he's also being able to spot the talent that can keep him relevant, if that makes sense. You kind of get to a point where Bowie had kind of led the agenda for so long. And it wasn't that I wouldn't say he was behind the times at all here, but he was kind of, the agenda had kind of kept up with him, but you can always see the people that can keep him going. So you mentioned Pat Metheny there, who, you said yourself, one of the greatest guitarists of the era, but a very jazz guitarist. Now, Bowie had always been interested in jazz music. If you look at even the early Aladdin Sane, it's Mike Garson, his piano playing over that album is incredible. And it's all jazz based, and that comes back around. Mike Garson joins him again in the 90s. I think he's back on some of the later stuff as well, if I remember rightly. His last album, Bowie's last album, Black Star, that was kind of Donny McCaslin's jazz band, helped form most of that sound. Again, a New York outfit, a very small jazz ensemble. So Pat Metheny really is right in the middle of Bowie going, well, what's going on in jazz today? If you listen to the song they did together, This Is Not America, I think it's a song that's probably aged better than it was received at that time. It's kind of this sort of, kind of a bit of a pop ballad, a bit meandering. But when you listen to it, it's a pop song with all these jazz chord changes in it that wouldn't have happened. Bowie wouldn't have written that on his own, but neither would Pat Metheny have probably brought it into the charts without Bowie. And funnily enough, when Pat Metheny was asked if he wanted to collaborate with Bowie for it, I think the film was called The Falcon and the Snowman.
Yeah. That's the one, yeah.
Ironically, Pat Metheny didn't know who Bowie was at the time. And Pat himself has been at pains to say, not because he didn't care. He was just such in the jazz world. To know who this big pop star was wasn't on his radar. But when they were put together, Pat realized kind of what a talent he was working with and kind of called it a real honor to be able to get that opportunity.
You talk about Bowie knowing sort of, because he's done his own part. He doesn't need to prove anything by the mid to 90s. So he could have just retired and done his own thing, but he keeps his finger in musically. And I'm going to run out of time, damn it. But we've got, you know, he gets involved with Trent Reznor, who is, I mean, now people may not know who he is, but blimey, they should go and hit his back catalogue because he has been there or thereabouts, and he is one of the most influential figures in music going on today, Nine Inch Nails, etc. But also Placebo, absolutely. You know, and he's getting involved with this way, not as a sort of look at me, I'm, you know, like Jagger, look at me, I'm hip, I'm down with the kids, but it's very much that elder statesman or, you know, that hip uncle, but in a good way, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you have, as we sort of said earlier, Bowie, if maybe his early collaborations like Lou and Iggy was maybe Bowie taking his heroes and lifting them up now that he had the fame and the kind of cachet to be able to do that. In this later period, you've got Bowie still using his fame to help people up, but to help give people a start, if you like, and to help give them a bit of a profile at the back of him. So I think the first Trent Reznor collaboration was I'm Afraid of Americans, wasn't it? Which Trent remixed for Bowie. Then they went out on tour together. So Bowie gave him the opening slot. I think they then performed, instead of sort of being a traditional opening slot interval Bowie headliner, they then performed sort of two or three songs together in the crossover. And then it became Bowie's set. Without You and Nothing is the Placebo song, isn't it? You look at what Placebo were doing at the time, and you know, it's a hop, skip, and a jump away from what Bowie was doing 20 years earlier. So you could see Bowie finding kindred spirits here, people who are looking in new directions, trying to find new sounds, trying to create something thoroughly modern, and him going, I can help give you a profile and a platform to bring this out on. And it even went on until the early noughties, I think, before his sort of enforced retirement, if you like, or maybe just after, I can't remember, but Arcade Fire, they did a song called Reflector on their third album, if I recall, might be the fourth. And Bowie does a guest vocal on that. And he's also doing things with TV on the Radio and kind of these kind of hip indie bands that are kind of, you know, into this weird math rock period and stuff like that. And he kind of was always there and always sort of championing these people and giving them space and kind of, you know, the Bowie stamp of approval right up until his death.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we're gonna have to leave it in a minute, but it's, you look at how Bowie goes through his career and the people he gets involved with, and like I said, Placebo, Arcade Fire, they're not hit singles. It's not Elton doing, you know, remixing Rocket Man with Dua Lipa. I mean, it's serious art rather than look at me, I'm still relevant. And it just makes you wonder. I mean, he was only 69 when he left us, and it just makes you wonder, another 10 years of collaborations or another 10 years of production, if he'd wanted to do it, if his illness had let him do it. But we you know, there are some pointers. I mean, you know, getting away from the ultimate 80s dancing in the street collaboration with Jagger, which is just, and the weirdness of Bing Crosby, Little Drummer Boy. It is worth having a look, isn't it? Going onto your back catalogue and finding these collaborations, because it does point to somebody who had their own path and made their influences.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think partly, this isn't just about the collaborations now, what I'm about to say, but that 90s period of Bowie was sort of overlooked a lot at the time. And I think there's a lot of drum and bass going on in music at the time, and kind of people thought, oh, Bowie's just doing a bit of that and, you know, dabbling in this sort of thing. But actually, if you look back on that, I think a lot of that has a lot more longevity, particularly his Outside album, which was his reuniting with Brian Eno in the mid-90s. And that sort of stuff that's really, really worth looking at again, absolutely.
Well, and again, we had the whole Britpop thing as well, didn't we? So he was stuck between a rock and a hard place, because he was never going to do drum and bass, really, and but like things like Little Monsters. But it is an interesting one. But if people want to find out more information about you, I know that you've got a LinkedIn profile. Where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm not a huge social media user, but LinkedIn/Jason-Draper-UK, and you will be able to keep up on what I'm doing at the moment.
Jason, I was looking forward to doing this interview. I thought it might be a good one. It's been an absolutely outstanding one, Jason Draper, thank you so much for your time today.
No, thank you, Jas. I've really enjoyed it.